Uncover from CBC Podcasts is your source for exceptional storytelling and groundbreaking journalism. Unveil the shocking secrets of one of Canada's most prolific fashion moguls.
He far exceeds Jeffrey Epstein. He far exceeds Bill Cosby.
And dive into the unsolved murders of two Canadian billionaires.
This is a perfect storm of conspiracy theory. It's got all the ingredients, none of the answers.
With new episodes released weekly, you'll hear the very best in award-winning true crime. Listen to Uncover wherever you get your podcasts. This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Brent Bambury. This is day six.
Get back!
I just saw police use unnecessary violence.
Go back to class and stop the nonsense.
Overwhelming amount of force against a group of college students.
This movement is mushrooming.
While tensions rise on campus, a blacklist targets pro-Palestinian activists. That's coming up on day six today. India's problem with hate speech.
Modi has built his image as a hardcore Hindu nationalist.
How the Indian election may intensify attacks on Muslims. When Taylor pays your rent.
It's only been out for a week and it's already my best-selling item.
How selling merch to Swifties can change your life. And building a better cow.
If I eat meat, that's the kind of meat I want to eat.
A farmer explains why his cattle emit less methane. All today on day six. The Emission Accomplished Edition. On campuses across the United States, pro-Palestinian protests are intensifying, and so are the ways that universities are trying to manage them. In the past week, police intervened in demonstrations everywhere from California to Texas to Florida. Hundreds of people were arrested. Craig Burkhead Morton was one of them.
I'm currently a member of the steering committee of Yellies for Palestine, and I've been one of the organizers and participants in the Gaza Solidarity encampment at Yale.
Craig says when the New York City police raided an encampment at Columbia University last week, groups at Yale decided to set one up in solidarity. Jewish students and student groups have reported a dramatic rise in anti-Semitism on campuses since October 7th. But Craig says that's not what he's seen at the Yale protest.
Obviously, what we're doing is not to foment hatred or to cause violence, but is to raise awareness and to force our university to do its part in putting an end to the war in Gaza. And it's unfortunate that classic American culture wars, Muslim versus Jews narrative is sort of being put forward. Over the course of the week, we had the Maghrib prayer, which is the Muslim sunset prayer on the plaza. Jewish students led us in prayer and song in the nighttime. And on Passover, on Monday, Jewish students organized a seder with the occupation. And so, you know, religion has been a key part of what we're doing. We come out because of our religious values as Muslims, as Jews, and as Christians.
The encampment at Yale lasted for several days. On Sunday, they held a rally attended by about 1,000 people. And on Monday morning, police moved in.
Which is truly unfortunate given that for the past 6 months, the university has refused to recognize the crisis in Palestine or to engage with students' demands to end its complicity with what's going on. Unfortunately, for the first time, the way that the university has chosen to engage with us is to put the police on us. You know, given that the students engaging in the occupation are mostly Black students, Jewish students, Muslim students, Arab students, it shows that they in a way they don't care about our safety.
Craig says 48 people were arrested.
I had my book bag and a duffel bag confiscated the day of my arrest. The duffel bag included my medication as well as my prayer rug and other religious materials. So it's quite distressing.
They were charged with Class A misdemeanors, punishable with up to a year in jail. They're due in court on May 8th, less than a week after final exams.
It was quite shocking to be treated that way, particularly given just sort of the harassment that Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim community members had been met with throughout the past 6 months, who have been engaging with the issue of Palestine peacefully, as well as our Jewish community members who were harassed by pro-Israel students, particularly on this past Saturday night, where they were harassed and recorded without their consent by sort of pro-Israel far-right forces on our campus.
Craig says there's still a heavy police presence on campus.
We are constantly being monitored and surveilled by the Yale Police Department, and university officials are very intent on stifling the movement that we're building. But at the same time, students are really, really enthused. Just a broad swath of the community is out. People who, you know, I had never seen a protest before prior to this. And so it's great to see that students feel comfortable engaging with the issue of Palestine for the first time, you know, doing their work. And despite, you know, the arrest that we've gone through, we've still been able to sustain programming. Teachers are having their classes outdoors with us. And so in that aspect, that's been very, very positive, and we look to keep that up.
Craig Burkhead Morton is a law student and pro-Palestinian protest organizer at Yale. As protests intensify, some of the student organizers are showing up on a website called Canary Mission. The website's been around since 2014. It lists photos and personal details of students and faculty involved in pro-Palestinian organizing on American campuses. There are also many Canadians on this list. James Bamford is a journalist who has reported on Canary Mission for The Nation. James, welcome to Day 6.
Well, good morning, Brett.
James, what is Canary Mission?
Canary Mission is a blacklisting and doxing operation directed from Israel, and it targets students and professors who are critical of Israeli policy. And it launches slanderous charges against them, puts their picture, biological or biographical information on the website, and basically tries to harass them so that they are no longer critical of Israel.
On the website, they characterize their mission quite a lot differently than how you just did. They say that they're documenting people and groups that promote hatred of the USA, Israel, and Jews. What's wrong with that idea?
Just about everything. If anybody's talked to any of the victims that have been on there, they don't qualify in any of those except the fact that they don't like Israel. I mean, they're not anti-Semitic. Israel is a country, not a religion. You know, the people that are on the list there, you're mostly dealing with college students. They're not out there with the Ku Klux Klan or something. They're studying. They realize that the Palestinians have not had freedom for generations and that they're critical of the Israeli policy.
How does a student go from being a protester on campus to being blacklisted and or doxed on this list? Who reported them, and then who submitted the names?
Well, there are people at the different campuses who are listening and reading and watching for people who are against Israel. And then they report them to Canary Mission. That's the only way it would work.
How did you find that out?
Well, there's been a lot written about it. First of all, the two most thorough examinations, Canary Missions, were done by, one was done by Haaretz, which is the leading Israeli newspaper. Mm-hmm. The other one was done by The Forward, which is the leading Jewish magazine in the United States. So these are the conclusions they came out with.
And as part of your reporting, you've spoken to people whose names have appeared on this list. What did they tell you? What were the consequences of being on the Canary Mission?
Well, it's frightening. And the whole idea here is to harass them enough so that they won't do what they're doing. They'll get out of the pro-Palestinian organization. They'll get out of the boycott. They won't say nasty things about Israel. Whatever. That's the goal.
I've seen reporting that says sometimes when one of these names is Googled, the Canary Mission report is the first thing that comes up. What are the implications for that person if that's the case?
Well, these are people that are looking for a job when they get out of grad school or law school, wherever. And they know that if they're on a list and that people who are doing the recruiting often look to the student's background. And if the first thing that comes up is this derogatory, slanderous charge sheet against them on Canary Mission, and there's four people competing for the job and three of them are not on Canary Mission and one of them is, obviously, then that person will, whether it's justified or not, will feel at a disadvantage and may not get the job because of that.
Canary Mission was originally run anonymously and they did not disclose information about who was involved or who funded it. But journalists have uncovered some information about that. Who is behind it?
Well, the journalists who uncovered that were actually the journalists that worked for the Jewish Forward, the Forward magazine, and the journalists who worked for the Israeli Haaretz. They were the ones who tracked it down and so forth. So this is not a conspiracy theory. This is a very capable journalist. And what they did was they found that a lot of the money was coming from Jewish organizations, wealthy organizations, wealthy individuals around the country. They could secretly send this money off to Canary Missions. For example, a very wealthy person in the San Francisco area of California, Stanford Diller, sent $100,000 off to Canary Mission. And the way he did it was to send it through the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco. And then they, in turn, send it to basically a front group that is in New York. And it's sort of a pass-through. It's called the Central Fund for Israel. That way they get a tax deduction on it, because if they send it directly to Israel, you don't get a tax deduction because it's outside the country. So the money goes from the donor, who in this case was Diller, to the Jewish organization, which was the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco. And from there, it goes to the Central Fund of Israel, which is basically, like I said, a front company and a front organization in New York. And from there, it goes to a group called Megamot Shalom. And that's, in essence, the front group in Israel that takes the money that's donated for Canary Mission.
Canary Mission has been in operation for about 10 years now. What effect do you think it has been? How effective has this campaign been in shaping the conversation around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
It has an enormous effect. One of the key aspects of this is to go around to the schools, particularly when around the time that they're having votes on divestment. And the idea is to scare these students away from voting for divestment. At George Washington University, for example, they had some people that came by dressed in canary outfits, and they basically tried to scare the students. And there were messages that went out to the students saying, we're going to know who you are if you vote for divestment. And then afterwards, they actually released the name and included them on Canary Mission.
Well, there's certainly been a change this week on campuses across the United States in terms of the scale of the protest. Do you think these kinds of methods will continue to be effective given the size of the protest and the number of students involved now?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's far more motivation for these for the blacklist to continue because the country is at war right now. So you have a lot of supporters who are very adamant that that they don't want criticism of this war, criticism of Israel's activities during the war on campuses.
James Bamford, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Brett.
James Bamford is a journalist who has reported on Canary Mission for The Nation. We asked Canary Mission to comment on this story. We did not hear back by our deadline. Here are some other stories we're keeping an eye on this weekend.
This is a critical time for wildfire in Alberta. Snow has melted and exposed dead and dry vegetation, which is extremely flammable.
Wildfire season is already underway in Western Canada. This week, several communities in BC and Alberta were told to evacuate or be on high alert. Alberta has brought in sweeping fire restrictions to manage risks. So far, Alberta has reported more than 200 fires this year, compared to 135 from the same time last year. Officials are urging extreme caution in the weeks ahead, as ongoing drought conditions increase the risk of wildfires. Without heavy spring rains, this year's season could be even worse than last year's record-breaking burns. And
the Thunder Bay Police Service has turned into a cold case factory when it comes to investigations into the deaths of Indigenous peoples.
First Nation leaders are calling for the Thunder Bay Police Force to be disbanded. They also want an outside police service to look into the recent deaths of three Indigenous people. The Ontario Provincial Police has laid multiple criminal charges against the former police chief, the former police service lawyer, and a staff sergeant. Findings of systemic racism and bias in the Thunder Bay Police Force go back several years. Current Thunder Bay Police Chief Darcy Fleury said this week the force is working to rebuild the trust with the community. Still to come on Day 6, hate speech is increasing in India. What role does the ruling party play as the election unfolds?
Using those talking points is extremely shocking.
In case you missed it, Taylor Swift dropped a new album last weekend, and not surprisingly, her fans are a little excited.
We are living through the Taylor Swift era, and it is a blessing.
The peak of Taylor Swift, and it is truly, truly...
It's too much.
I couldn't ask for more in this lifetime. I really couldn't.
Within 3 days, the Tortured Poets Department sold more than 700,000 vinyl copies and broke the record for LP sales. Oh, and the previous record holder, that was Taylor Swift. 1989, Taylor's version to be precise. It's no secret that Taylor Swift has been a huge boost to the economy. It's estimated that her Eras tour contributed more than $4 billion to America's GDP. And it's not just Taylor Swift who benefits. There's a whole shadow economy that gets a boost whenever she does something new.
My name is Holly Turner, and I run an online merch store.
Holly has a shop on Etsy.
You can find me by searching Holly Turner Design Co. on Etsy is the easiest way.
Holly opened her store in October of 2022, a little before the Eras tour started. But the Etsy store wasn't her main source of income.
I am a music photographer, graphic designer, and videographer. So that means that I work with a lot of artists who are touring, and I will join their tours and do photo and video for them. And I also do their graphic design work and social media in addition to that.
She played around with some of her designs and put them on Etsy.
I've always been in her fan community online. I've just always been a really huge fan. Predominantly, I had a fan account on Tumblr. And something that I would do would be make edits of her stuff. So, you know, if a lyric really inspired me, I'd take some photos of her and like edit them and edit the lyrics really nicely and put those on top. And then it kind of just was born out of a different creative medium that I was just inspired by a song title, and I thought, oh, this would make a really cool shirt that I can kind of just build off of this song title. It's putting really cool ideas in my head. So I just made it as a shirt, and then I posted it online, and then a bunch of my friends from within the fan base were like, oh, I would buy this. So I just put it up on Etsy, and it kind of just took off from there.
Holly sells t-shirts, sweatshirts, and hats, as well as some candles, and her best-selling item is also one of her newest.
I have a shirt that I just rolled out, actually, that says, Greetings from Florida, Taylor and Florence, kind of inspired by the track Florida on the Tortured Poets Department, her newest album, and that one has really taken off. I think it was on the homepage on Etsy the other day, which was super, super cool. It's only been out for a week, and it's already my best-selling item, which is really exciting. And then I had one as well with just kind of a reimagining of the Eras Tour merch that she has. It's sort of a creative spin on what's there that I have that's also sold really well.
And Holly's not the only one. The sales of unofficial T-Swift merchandise are an economy all on their own. According to Bloomberg, nearly 95% of Swifties have purchased Taylor-related merch in the past year, and about half of them have bought unofficial merch, like the shirts and outfits you'll find on Etsy. And for Holly, those sales have changed her life.
It's given me a lot of freedom, which has been really nice, because having supplemental income is such an incredible gift, especially as someone who freelances, which is how I you know, take on my gigs in my regular job. So if someone comes to me with a tour that they want me on or a photo shoot that they want me to do, I don't have to say yes just because I need the money. I have a source of income and something that I can work on if I'm not taking any tours or any photo shoot gigs. So I can have the freedom to only say yes if I'm passionate about the work. And so I can make clothes that inspire me. And then I also have the financial freedom to take jobs that inspire me. And yeah, I've been someone that budgets really, really hard throughout my life. And doing this has given me the ability to, you know, if I want to go out for dinner, I don't really have to worry about it. And I can't go crazy, of course, but there's just a lot more freedom to be like, I feel like doing this. You know what? I've made 10 sales today. I can do that. That's okay. And that's been really, really nice.
As you might imagine, Taylor Swift has hundreds of copyright registrations. There's even a complete guide to all of her copyrights online. They include her name and words like Swifty, Swiftmas, Taymoji, and Shake It Off. So Holly's careful not to copy the singer's official merchandise line.
As someone who is an artist, it's really important to me not only to respect Taylor's copyright, but also to respect the copyright of all of the graphic designers that work with her, all of the photographers, stuff like that. So a lot of Etsy shops will use photos of her, they'll use her fonts, they'll create knockoffs of stuff that she has in her merch store. And it is really, really, really important to me to not do any of that. So everything in my shop is like an illustration that has come completely from me and from my brain. I'm kind of just saying like, oh, this song lyric inspires me, so I'm gonna take, you know, that and create something new with it. And I feel like that's kind of the dividing line between what is fair use and what is infringing on someone's copyright. Is, are you taking an idea and making it your own, or are you just copying something that she had done? And I try really, really hard to not cross that line.
But you have to think the good times can't roll on forever, right? Even for Taylor Swift.
That is definitely something that I've thought about. I definitely, during the break between Eras Tour and the announcement of Tortured Poets, my sales went down quite a bit. However, I view this as kind of a blessing and a fun project as opposed to something that I'm relying on. So I think the good thing is that I have the ability to, this is cool for right now, it's awesome. If it dries up a little bit, then I'm okay with that.
Holly's a huge T-Swift fan. She even got a little help directly from Taylor Swift during the pandemic.
At the beginning of the pandemic, I made a post on Tumblr about how I was really struggling working in the music industry. That was one of the worst affected types of careers you could have for the pandemic. Everyone was just completely out of work, especially working in events because there were no events. So I made a post on Tumblr explaining that, and Taylor actually saw it and she sent me $3,000, and that paid my rent for most of lockdown over the summer of the pandemic. She's, oh my God, literally just the most incredible person. And she then proceeded to donate a lot of money to a lot of fans who were struggling for various reasons during the pandemic. And she also donated to like record stores in Nashville to keep them open and things like that. But I was the first one that she sent money to, which was so, so, so cool. So, so, so amazing.
Holly is hoping to branch out and create more of her own personal designs. But for now, she's thankful to be living in the Taylor Swift era and the Taylor Swift economy.
I think that it's so cool that so many people in so many different genres with so many different interests. There's like Taylor Swift DJ nights that happen all around the country. I think those are so cool when they're run by actual Swifties. So many people have been able to chase their dreams and do their passions via someone that they are passionate about. And I think that that is just so magical, honestly. I think that that's really, really cool. And it's amazing that someone has the ability to inspire people that much. And so many people care about her that entire ecosystems can be created within that, that make people a living. I think that's awesome.
Holly Turner is a photographer, graphic designer, and videographer. Her Etsy shop is Holly Turner Design Co.
You can beat the heat if you beat the charges too. They said I was a cheat. Guess it must be true. And my friends all smell like weed or little babies. And the city reeks of driving myself crazy. Little did you know your home's really only a town you're just a guest in. So you work your life away just to pay for a timeshare down in Destin, Florida.
और पहले जब उनकी सरकार थी उन्होंने कहा था कि देश की संपत्ति पर पहला अधिकार मुसलमानों का है. इसका मतलब ये संपत्ति इकट्ठी करके किसको बांटेंगे? जिनके ज्यादा बच्चे हैं उनको बांटेंगे.
That's Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi speaking at a campaign rally in Rajasthan last Sunday. Modi is facing accusations of hate speech for what he said that day. He and his ruling Hindu nationalist BJP have been in power since 2014. Modi is now running for a third term in office. Voting in India's national election began last week and runs until June 1st. In his speech on Sunday, Modi used a number of anti-Muslim tropes. And according to Raqib Hamid Naik, Modi's speech is just the tip of the iceberg. Naik is the founder of the India Hate Lab. It's a U.S.-based group that documents hate speech and disinformation in India. Raqib, good morning. Welcome to Day 6.
Thank you for having me, Brent.
What exactly did Prime Minister Narendra Modi say on Sunday?
Prime Minister Modi made these remarks at an election rally in claiming that the opposition party Congress will gather all the wealth and resources of the country and distribute it among those who have more children, alluding it to Muslims, and among those who are infiltrators, also implying Muslims, because these are the anti-Muslim tropes that we have been documenting over the years. So these remarks at the rally represent a dangerous display of his deeply entrenched hate towards India's 200 million Muslim minority. And this coming from the highest office in the land only serves to stoke further discrimination and violence against Muslims.
When you hear those words, words like infiltrators, what does that suggest to you?
If we look at the kind of narrative that is being pushed around over the past decade, is that Muslims are someone who Hindus should fear because they are going to take over the country. They are producing so many children, as you would see with the white supremacist great replacement theory. Mm-hmm. And then also Muslims are in record number are infiltrating into the country as undocumented illegal immigrants. And eventually they are going to install their prime minister in the country. And this is, for example, the last time India is going to have a Hindu prime minister. So we got to save our country from that. These are all the kind of narrative, kind of conversation that happen at a lot of these different far-right events around the country. But Prime Minister Narendra Modi directly using those talking points is extremely shocking. Internationally, many people are taken aback by his speech. But I think those who are familiar with Modi's ascent and his Hindu nationalist ideology recognize it as a consistent with his true beliefs, because Modi has built his image as a hardcore Hindu nationalist leader mm-hmm. and a supposed protector of Hindu interests over the bodies of nearly 2,000 Muslims who were killed by mobs in Gujarat state in 2002 during his tenure as the state's prime minister. So anyone expecting a change in his approach or attitude towards minorities has been literally living in a parallel universe. In fact, throughout his last decade in office, he has been consistent with his disdain for minorities, especially Muslims and Christians. Discriminatory policies like the recent Citizenship Amendment Act and his election speeches.
But if you're not expecting change from Modi, then what makes these remarks so different from inflammatory remarks that he's made in the past?
During his tenure as a prime minister, he hasn't directly used the word Muslim to directly target the community. He has, in fact, for example, in 2020, at an election rally, he mentioned that you can identify rioters with their clothes, mm-hmm. attributing it to Muslims, mm-hmm. like, you know, these anti-Muslim dog whistles. But this is the first time he's directly pointed out Muslims and then attributed these characteristics to them, that they are people who produce more children. And this is a conspiracy theory that has been going in India for a very long time, but especially over the past decade, this has kind of caught in the grip of the popular imagination, especially in the Hindus. So this promotion of this manufactured fear of the other, that these 14% minorities are a threat to majority, this is something extremely dangerous that is happening this time around.
And this is, of course, happening in the context of India's national election.
Yes.
On Tuesday, India's Election Commission said that it would examine this complaint against Modi. But how far do you expect the Election Commission of India to go in challenging him?
As of now, over 20,000 people have written to the Election Commission. Mm. But so far, the commission has neither put out a statement nor taken any suo motu cognizance. But as you said, the commission did forward the opposition Congress party's complaint against PM Modi's speech to the BJP president, seeking his response. But I think going by the history of the commission in dealing with complaints against members of the ruling party, I don't think anything is going to come out of it. And the person in question is the prime minister of the country. So they'll be very careful on how they deal with it.
Your organization, the India Hate Lab, you have found that hate speech in India has been on the rise. What are your latest numbers and findings?
So in February, we released our report on in-person hate speech events that were held throughout India in 2023. And we have recorded 668 hate speech events targeting Muslims throughout the entire calendar year. Mm. That's on an average 2 anti-Muslim hate speech events daily. Mm-hmm. And 75% of these events took place in states ruled by PM Modi's party. In fact, among the top 8 states with the most hate speech events, 6 were ruled by the BJP throughout the year. And the extremely concerning part is that the 36% of the overall speeches were categorized by us as dangerous speeches, which includes a direct call to violence. And the person who delivered most dangerous speeches throughout the year is a BJP legislator from the state of Telangana named T. Raja Singh.
Have you been able to document any instances where those calls to violence or other hate speech have actually led to violence, where people have been hurt?
In fact, at the lab, over the years doing this work, we have found that there is this hate-violence triangle. This is a repeating feature that we have seen in a lot of different BJP rural states, where you will have these far-right Hindu groups, including the members of BJP, organizing these events where hate speeches against minorities would be delivered. Mm-hmm. And then after a series of events, there is a trigger incident, and that trigger incident results in a violence. Then state comes into action and double downs on the violence against minorities by indulging in arbitrary arrests and using bulldozers to demolish Muslim properties.
Hmm. Raqib, how does this redound politically for the BJP? What advantage is there in using this kind of language and building support for Modi or for his party?
We know that for sure, and academics have done a lot of work on it, that these hate speech events do result in polarization of the electorate, which mm-hmm. in turn helps the BJP in winning elections. When you have hate being produced at such an industrial scale, and these 668 events are the ones that we were able to get hold of, mm-hmm. there are so many others that we would never know, like, what the real number really is. But the scale of it is literally at an industrial level. When you put so much of hate in the society, it has to come out in one form or the other. Politically, they come and vote for the party that they think is their savior, because that's what they are projecting themselves, that we are here to defend you against this threat, this enemy. With this latest example, with the prime minister of the country indulging in hateful and bigotry, we know for sure that now this hate is also being effectively used to radicalize and indoctrinate the majority community against the minority group. Hate speech has literally become part and parcel of the socio-political sphere in India today.
Modi and the BJP are widely expected to win this third term. So what are you expecting from a third term of a Modi government? Where do you think he will go with this kind of Hindu nationalism if he wins?
I think as we go through these multiple phases of elections, we are going to see an extreme surge in hate, misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories targeting minorities over the next 2 months. Mm-hmm. And I think should the BJP win again, I believe that we could see a new dark era of hate and disinformation not ever seen in our recent memory. It would also herald an era of authoritarianism on steroids. And to be a member of a minority community in India is going to be extremely scary.
Raqib Hamid Naik, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Brent.
Raqib Hamid Naik is the founder of the India Hate Lab. Still to come on Day 6, gassing down, the quest for a lower methane cow.
The climate is changing, so are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brent Bambury. You're listening to Day 6 from CBC Radio. We're on public radio stations across the United States. You can listen on demand with the CBC Listen app. And we're available wherever you get your podcasts and at cbc.ca/day6. Any day now, a pretty exciting thing is going to happen in the sky. Not the eclipse. That's over. Move on already. I'm talking about the next big thing. T. Corona Borealis, or if you're in the know,
T. Cor Bor.
That's Nicole Mortellaro. She's a senior science reporter with CBC. She's also a total space geek.
I love the stars, and I just love space, and I want everybody else to love it too.
So T. Cor Bor is a star system. Anytime you look at the sky, it's up there, but most of the time, you're not going to be able to see it.
This star is invisible to the unaided eye, but every 79 to 80 years, it brightens.
That's because T. Cor Bor is something known as a recurrent nova. There are two stars, and they are orbiting around each other.
So we have these two stars, the red giant, that's shedding off all this material. And, you know, it's all piling up on this tiny white dwarf. Now, a white dwarf is a tiny star that's very dense. And so it's taking on all this material. Imagine, if you would, you have a balloon, right? And you're pushing more and more air into it. Your air is the material that is coming off that red giant. And what happens when that balloon can't take any more air, can't take anymore. Pop, it goes. And we get that thermonuclear explosion, that nova, and the star is going to brighten in the sky. This process happens roughly every 79 to 80 years. So here we are, tick-tock. This is the 80th year, and astronomers are looking at the brightness of this star. And just before it goes, boom, it actually dips in brightness. And that's where we are now. It's dipped in brightness. So now we're all eagerly, you know, waiting for this star to go boom.
For most people, unless they're very young, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
These don't happen often. Recurrent novas, there are only about 10 known ones. And this is the only one that happens within our lifetime. The other ones have a much longer time span between these recurrent eruptions. We tend to think that things are stagnant in the night sky. We see the stars, we see the moon, it moves, you know, night after night. But the stars relatively, during our lifetime, stay in place and don't do much of anything, right? They're moving very, 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 very slightly. So to see an exploding star, to see this change in the night sky, that's what makes it really exciting, at least for me.
And it's galvanized astronomers around the world.
You know, scientists didn't understand this. Astronomers didn't understand this until 1946. It's only 80 years now. So they only have really that one observation to look at what it's done in the past. But what's really cool about this is instead of in 1946, you had professional astronomers looking at the star. This time, You've got amateurs all over the world, and they are contributing to science. You have eyes all over the world that are looking at this and that'll be able to give a lot more information than in 1946. So that's also what makes this event particularly special.
And Nicole doesn't want to miss it.
Every clear night, I'm walking out and I'm looking towards the constellation, and I'm really hoping that I'll be there to see it actually explode. But, you know, what are the chances? Seeing something like this, it reminds you of how small you are. Our universe is constantly evolving and constantly carrying on and doing its thing while we sit here in our very short lifespan, and there's so much we don't understand.
TCOR Bohr is expected to brighten anytime between now and September.
So when TCOR Bohr goes nova, you have a very short window to see it, about 1 or 2 days. Then it starts to dim in brightness. But one thing I would suggest to people before it goes nova, go out and take a look, find that constellation, get used to seeing the stars, use a pair of binoculars, and then when it goes nova, you'll be able to pick it out in an instant.
There are astronomy phone apps to help you locate TCOR Bohr, and unlike that loser solar eclipse, TCOR Bohr will be visible all across Canada.
I'm just really hoping it goes nova on a clear night. Please, please, please.
Nicole Mortellaro is a senior science reporter with CBC. If you want to know more about TCOR Bohr, check out her reporting at cbc.ca.
I call myself an environmentalist, and if I can produce animals that really produce less methane, people are going to listen and say, hey, if I eat meat, that's the kind of meat I want to eat.
That's Dave Braden. He's a beef farmer near Hamilton, Ontario. And for decades, he's been on a mission to breed cattle that are more energy efficient and less harmful to the environment. Dave Braden did not set out to become a farmer. He's also been a city councillor, and he's got a background in energy-efficient home building. But he got into raising cattle because he likes a challenge, and he doesn't like to take no for an answer. Dave Braden, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Morning, Brent. Good to talk to you.
You say your cattle produce 30% less methane. How do you know that? How do you measure the methane output of a cow?
Some initial research was done where they literally put a cow in a kind of a vessel, like in a laboratory room, and they measured the precise amount of methane coming from that animal. But what they learned from that was there's a direct correlation between how much an animal eats and how much methane is produced. Mm-hmm. And that's now accepted by science. So rather than putting every one of my cows into a separate vessel and measuring it, we can measure that with some confidence if we can measure how much they physically eat. I only select bulls to use on my herd, so for the future generation, I only use animals that have a genetic ability to eat less and therefore produce less methane.
Okay, and so your animals then, I would assume, are eating 30% less. What are the traits that you're looking for if you're genetically engineering an animal that doesn't require as much food or is more efficient in the consumption of food than another?
It's not that complicated. The thing we're looking for is the conversion efficiency of what they eat. So in my case, that's just grass. In most cases, it's grass and then plus a heavy grain ration at the latter part of their life. I think the science shows it doesn't matter what kind of a diet they're on. Mm-hmm. There are some that are simply much better converters. So I would use the words, they're more efficient at converting grass into red meat.
But you must be pretty good at spotting the ones that are more efficient. I mean, what are the traits you're looking for?
In the industry now, we can now actually measure with quite a bit of accuracy certain traits. Let me tell you this. You'll think this is pretty strange. I can take a hair sample from a young animal, male or female. But let's say in this case, it's a male. And I can take a hair sample out of the bull calf's tail, and I can send that to a lab. And from that hair sample, we can predict with reasonable, not more than confidence, but reasonable accuracy, how efficient his offspring are going to be in converting grass into muscle or red meat. The way you make improvements in the animal business is in the following generation through the genetics of the male you use to improve your herd.
These are not grain-fed beasts. These are grass-fed. So there's differences in quality there, which I want to talk to you about. But there are two things here. There's the methane they produce, but there's also the fossil footprint that's created by what they eat. And if they're eating grain, you have to bring that grain into your farm. So that expands the fossil fuel footprint. Why is it so important to you? Tell me about like the philosophical difference between grain-fed and grass-fed cattle.
In 1980, you know, I was a young adult, and I could see that we had a real problem with fossil fuel. I thought, we got to find something better for the economy, and we got to find something better for cattle. Mm-hmm. In those days, in 1980, and I have it on record from a very senior animal scientist, they said, you can't raise animals economically that'll suit the needs of the market if you don't feed them grain. But I'm a bit stubborn taking that kind of advice. So we decided to, over the generations, select animals that we knew at that time. We didn't have the science, but we sort of were confident that ate less or produced more or both. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm past my best before date. And I want to make at least a contribution, if not through the animals, at least through knowledge. So what we have proven here for sure is that you can grow animals and finish them, put on an appropriate amount of fat, because that's what the market wants, without any grain at all. And 40 years ago, people said that was impossible.
Right.
And today, people, they can come here and they can say, obviously they do.
What do your profit margins say about creating a more efficient grass-fed cow?
I mean, that's a personal question. I'm happy to answer it because I need to share that. If we compare what I'm trying to do to what a normal beef farmer is doing, everything we do slightly differently, and we're well aware of the economic impacts of the way you farm or the way you market. Mm-hmm. We sell beef directly to an individual like yourself. We purposely charge more money than you pay if you go at the supermarket. Let's say you're going to sell a steer. It doesn't matter what the way. And we put a we sell that steer to a buyer for $2,400. Okay, and today the farmers are doing pretty well on that. But this might be temporary. When I sell a steer to you or to a person, I pay for the butchering. And I receive all of the benefit of the marketing and the middleman and all that stuff and the cutting and the wrapping and I do the sales stuff. I get more than $5,000. And of course, I'm not getting rich because I'm trying to improve the herd. And what I'm really trying to do is find places like this where I can share this information so other farmers who are working just as hard as I am are going to get a decent return.
Dave, you're doing this, though, at a comparatively small scale. Do you think that this could scale up to the level of being a supplier to a major chain or something?
I tell you, I've got a mentor in Alberta, and he calves out 560 cows. I want to calve out 12 because I want to have enough number that I can convince myself that these animals are good or bad and I can measure them. You know, farming is a hard way to make a living. If you had any number of cows from, say, 30 to 300, I think you could make a tremendous living. So I guess the simple answer, yes, you could scale this up, and yes, you could do very well, and it'll happen. When the big guys notice all of a sudden they can double their profits, way more than double their profits, they're going to do this. But like anything in change, everybody poo-poos it to begin with, and then they put it down, and then they think, well, maybe it's all right, and maybe they try it. In 10 or 15 years, there'll be a lot of people doing this.
I want to talk about sustainability again, because your approach still produces some carbon emissions. It produces fewer of them than industrial farming, for sure. But ultimately, how far can your approach go in making beef or dairy farming something that is sustainable for the globe?
My sense is that it's already there. Now, look, I understand, and I call myself an environmentalist proudly, but I'm not the sharpest, scientist on the block. They produce methane. They always have. The number of animals, I think, is going down. So I don't want to have to work too hard to justify this. So I'm doing what I can to reduce the methane level. Other than the methane, this model we have is very sustainable, even in a climate like Canada's. I mean, this would be so darn easy to do in Florida, where they got lots of beef farms, and we got a lot of Canadian farmers are owning land in Florida trying to produce sort of a low energy beef animal.
Right.
You know, we are feeding hay 6 months of the year, so we're going to be feeding hay for another normally till the first week in May. This year it might be a little less. You need energy to run the machinery to do that, but comparatively speaking, to not using grain, and still I have a problem sort of morally. In a time now when I'm not sure the world really can feed itself, to be growing grain, needing fossil fuel to feed animals, sounds a bit too much for me to stomach. So I just want to provide a proven scientific answer that is sustainable. I believe that we'll be farming like this for the next 200 years, if everybody's still around. One thing that I can't explain, but everybody accepts, they've been in farming. If you have a piece of grassland, a field, and you don't do anything with it and just leave it in grass, I mean, it'll probably revert to forestry a bit eventually. But if you put cattle on it, there is something about the manure. It seems that the manure is almost a perfect additive to bring life back to that field. So the field's way better after you put cattle in it.
Dave Braden, nice talking to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Certainly has been a pleasure. Thank you, Brent.
Dave Braden is a cattle farmer in Flamborough, Ontario.
Time, weather, and
Rift from the headlines.
And here we go. It's Rift from the headlines, our weekly quiz. Three rifts linked by one story in the news. If you guess the story that links the rifts, you could win a day 6 tote bag. First, this is a recap. Here's last week's clue. David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars and Suffragette City. The Blue Raincoats with Girls in Uniform and Miguel Bosé with Olympic Games. Suzette Narbonne of Sechelt, BC correctly guessed the headline we're looking for. U.S. Women's Olympic Team slams skimpy uniforms. Long jumper Tara Davis Woodall said her hoo-ha would be out. That's true. She said that. You can look it up. Congratulations, Suzette. A Day 6 tote bag will be on its way to you soon. Now, here's this week's clue.
Let's get started. I can hardly wait. Doing the show is going to be great. Come on, everybody, let's go. We're putting on a show.
Go see a musical. A musical.
And we're looking for the story that connects those rifts. Email us your answer. Put rift from the headlines in the subject. Send it to day6@cbc.ca. Please include your mailing address. One right answer will be picked at random. The prize is a Day 6 tote bag. You can always hear the clues again anytime at cbc.ca/day6.
Time, weather, and
rift from the headlines.
Thank you. And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, McKenna Hadley-Burke, Sarah Melton, and Pedro Sanchez. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott. Our intern is Sanfin Jacot. And I'm Brent Bambury. It's 5 days till London, England votes for mayor, 7 days to Star Wars Day, and 7 days till we meet again on day 6.
I just love space.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.